Blog Talk Radio.
What good is music? What good is melody if it ain't possessing something sweet? It ain't the music, it ain't the melody. There's something else that makes that tune complete. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. A do what, 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 do what. It don't mean a thing, all you gotta do is sing. A do what, 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 do what. Makes no difference if it's sweet or hard. You just give that rhythm everything you've got. Well, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. A do what, 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 do what. Makes no difference if it's sweet or hard. You just give that rhythm everything you've got. Well, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. I do what, 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 do what. I do what, 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 do what. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
Welcome to the Spirit of America Party and the Spirit of America Party book. Well, we were listening to Mike Savage today, and I can't believe how confident Mike is as he gifts the Ukrainian people to Putin. I could understand it if it was Obama losing the entire Middle East with the help of his goon networks, the Communist News Network, CNN, and nothing but communists, NBC, but to slander the patriotic intentions of hardworking people sacrificing their lives to overthrow a bad choice. Savage condemns these freedom seekers, yet he does not call for the firing of the American bad choice, Obama bin Laden. When people start calling people Nazis, that's a communist tactic. Nazism died in 1945, and that was the end of the Nazi Party, which was a socialist party, the same as the Communist Socialist Party. The only difference between Nazis and communists are uniforms. So Savage brings out this crazy man named Paul Craig Roberts from the prison planet, and he convinces a Savage that communism is dead all over the world. 40% of the world is communist, and every day they get stronger. Just remember that. The entire Middle East has, every country in the Middle East has a communist party. Every country in Africa has a communist party. The Cuban communists have been in Africa since before NAM. And many of the Cuban communists have influenced Africans to the point that they control many seats in a government. And now the Chinese are looking at Africa. And I don't know if you ever watched the guys that went for gold in Guyana, and they had to walk past another mining outfit to get to their mine. And they were all Chinese, and they were watching them with hate in their eyes. And they all had shotguns, and these guys were unarmed. These Americans were unarmed. So, communism is stronger today than ever before. The wall came down, and the communists came here. And now we have a nut job for a governor in New York who says that you don't need 6 bullets to kill a deer. And he's sitting up there in Albany with his Davy Crockett hat on. And then you have a communist mayor in New York City who is going to play communist Robin Hood. Rob from the rich and give it to other rich. Yeah, that's what Obama's doing. I haven't seen Obama with poor people since he got elected. He is with all the big spenders. I haven't seen him. Maybe one rally he'll go out and he'll shake hands with somebody and say, yes, I feel your pain. And then bartender a champagne. But Savage is altogether wrong on this thing. I see these people. He calls the women in the Ukraine, the young girls, you know, with the tight jeans. Yeah, with the Jordache jeans. He is knocking them. Those girls are out there, those young girls are out there, they take bullets. And if you notice that during the attempt to destroy the demonstrators, when the police opened up on them, many had taken headshots and lung shots and heart shots. So, and now they want the president to stand trial for the murder of 80 demonstrators. And he's nowhere to be found. So Savage has made a wrong call here, and this guy, Paul Craig Roberts, definitely sounds just like a communist. And speaking to Jimmy from Brooklyn, and he says, yeah, these intellectuals, they go to Russia, they learn the Russian language, they learn the Russian culture, they learn which are the good Russian wines to drink. He says, but that's it. They don't, they're communists. And this guy sounds like everybody was his enemy, from Bush to Clinton. If he was an American, he was an enemy. And this guy is a very important guy. He has BS'd his way to the top. And he's an advisor to presidents. And in reading about McCarthy and the people who had infiltrated the State Department during World War II, and they're all from the same ilk. They're the same type of intellectual. And as I read the descriptions of these guys who were convicted of being Soviet agents, this guy is saying the exact same thing that they were saying in the 40s. So I think Savage has done a disservice to the people of the Ukraine, and he has sold them out. And the reason he sold them out, I could understand. Putin is the stronger power. But isn't that the same as helping German refugees into rail cars when you do that? What happened to the American creed that the strong is supposed to protect the weak, including the unborn? Savage is all wrong on this one, and it's going to come back to haunt him. And the first night he went into this tirade, women called him who were Ukrainian, and one woman had two brothers that were killed by the Soviets. And never forget that Joseph Stalin killed 10 million Ukrainians. There'd be 10 million more at those demonstrations if Stalin hadn't starved them out. And what he did, that's the breadbasket of Russia. He seized their farms, and he took all their food, and then he locked them into solitary confinement in their own homes and starved them to death, 10 million of them. And if you ever see, Google it and see what it looked like. The families were eating the first of the children who died. It was absolutely sad. And that's how brutal Stalin was to his enemies. And when we lose, that's how brutal our enemies are going to be to us. And if you think you can stand in front of a firing squad and say you have rights, nobody's going to listen. That's like a hijacked plane when they tell you it's going back to the airport as it gets lower and lower in downtown New York. You better wake up, America. We're losing our country. And World War III is coming, and we're all invited. There's hearings tonight about our cyber protection. And And the guys that are explaining it on their watch, one guy stole, what was it, 800,000 emails? And there was two of them. There's the KGB agent who everybody thinks is a hero, a free speech hero, KGB agent Snowden. And then you've got the private Manning who leaked 200,000 memos because he was gay and he felt that gays weren't getting a fair shake. So he betrayed his country to even the score. That's wonderful. That's really wonderful. And it's really sad. So let's see what we can do here. And the economy is doing good. It's doing fantastic. One company laid off a whole bunch of employees today, and their stock went up because the more people they lay off, the better their bottom line looks. Isn't that fantastic?
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream, with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, brick, mortar, and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, he will look swell, full of that Yankee doodle-dee-dum. Half a million boots went marching through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Hey, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al, Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, and I made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Hey, brother, ain't got a dime about you, have you? And once I built a tower, yes, a tower to the sun, of brick, mortar, and lime. Yes, I'm the fella built the tower, and now it's done. Hey, buddy, ain't got a dime about you, have you? Once in khaki suits, he will look swell, full of that Yankee doodle-dee-dum. Half a million boots went marching through hell, and I was a kid with a drum. Say, don't you remember? Don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al. Al all the time. Don't you remember? I'm your pal. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Okay. Last night we gave you five new words, and here we're going to give you five new words tonight. The first one is efficacious, having the power to produce a desired effect. So how could you use efficacious? It would be like Kerry challenging Putin, daring him to invade the Ukraine, forcing him to invade the Ukraine and giving him the green light because Putin knows we're not going to do anything. So that's Obama's gift, that they played good communist, bad communist, and Putin won. And that's efficacious, the power to produce a desired effect. catchpole. A sheriff's deputy, especially one who makes arrests for failure to pay Obamacare. Meg saw the catchpole through the front door's peephole and then skipped out through the back door. Numismatic, this one. Last night I told you. Last night when I told you about the couple that found on their property 1,200 coins, gold coins, and it was worth $10 million. And I chuckled and I said, wait till you see who comes in the town. They'll be checking to see if there were any robberies back in 1840, you know. And who do you think came in this morning? The IRS, and they want $5 million, and they got to pay it by April the 15th. Now, what does that tell you? What fool finds $10 million in gold coins and jumps up and tells everybody? Wouldn't they be better off? They could have given $5 million away to charity and said, we only found $5 million. Then the IRS would only come in and take $2.5 million. Now, when you find money, you don't tell anybody. Take that from Grandpa Tom. Yeah. And see how quick the IRS picked up on that? $5 million. They took their cut a half. You know, it's like you go to work all week, and at the end of the week, you come home with the paycheck, and there's a guy sitting at the kitchen table from the IRS and says, how did we do this week? And I'll take half. Now, you tell me this isn't a mafia government. Hibernaculum, a shelter occupied during the winter by a dormant animal, or as an insect or a reptile. Oh, you mean like a termite? Like a termite that's gnawing away at the oak of freedom, running for re-election? Yeah. A congressman or a senator? Chivalry. A noisy mock serenade to a newly married couple. Now they don't do a chivalry. They do sit and shiver because the lawyer is at the wedding reception making arrangements for the divorce. Yeah, unbelievable. So there's our five new words, chivalry, the last one. Okay, we're going to go to my candidate for president. I'm the only guy that's touting this guy. I'm the only guy that's rooting for him. And I read you last night the chapter two of My Share of the Task. See, this guy's a team player, right? He was the number one commander in Afghanistan, but he says it was a task that he shared with his fellow soldiers. So we did Journey to the Plain last night. That was his time in West Point. And how he couldn't wait to get out of there because he wanted to go right to work. So Chapter 3, The Army in Which I Should Like to Fight. This is August the 76th to March 82. You're the United States of America. How could you let this happen? The question was passionate, like the officer who posed it. I had no good answer, either for Lieutenant Tawachi, the Thai Army officer with whom I developed a close relationship, or for myself. It was April 1980. The photographs in the media of wrecked U.S. aircraft and burned bodies in the Iranian desert were stark reflections of a failed attempt to rescue Americans held hostage in Tehran. I got to tell you something. After Nam and being stabbed in the back by the pothead communists in the United States, in the colleges, in the Congress, in the House and the Senate, the future flag burners of America betrayed the troops who were in rice paddies, bringing home body parts of their buddies. And when those poor bastards came home, they were spit on. And even the World War II vets felt that they were losers. And that's why many Vietnam vets did not want to join the veterans groups. They were bitter, and they had a right to be bitter. They got shafted. They got shafted. Al Gore went to NAMI, had 4 bodyguards. So there was preferential treatment, political influence. President Pinocchio Pants got out of the draft. Then Jimmy Carter pardoned him. I'd see communists take care of one another. That's the one thing Jimmy from Brooklyn says. If you're a communist, man, they'll give you anything you want. You want to be a commander? You can be a commander. They'll take you. They can make you president. Yeah. So these poor Vietnam vets, they really got the shaft. But the whole country was down and out because we had been chased out of Vietnam, and as opposed to Korea, where we saved half the peninsula and stopped the Chinese and the North Koreans from swallowing up South Korea. And I'm sure if you ask the South Koreans, who have lights and electricity, how they feel about it, and they would say, oh, never leave us. We may pretend not to like you, and the communists will do demonstrations, go home Yankee. But listen, when we hear those tanks warming up on the other side of the 38th parallel, we want to be your friend. And that's the name of that tune. And so the American people were really down and out. And the military was humiliated, humbled, and it was despised. You could just see what Hollywood did to the U.S. military in the movies. The My Lai massacre was the big takedown of the entire 585,000 Americans that were fighting in Nam. One rogue lieutenant and his platoon undid all the good that everybody does. It's like, you know, the good deeds cops do every day, and one rogue cop ruins it for everybody. So the American people were totally down and out, as were the veterans and the guys who were still serving in the military. And it was only until George Bush the elder, went to Kuwait and threw Saddam Hussein out. And we were all, let's face it, we were all pooping in our pampers, wondering if all of Saddam's bravado was going to come true. And weren't we happy when we saw the results, and when the tank column came out of the cloud, a sandstorm, and made a right-hand turn into Saddam's palace. And then Uday and Qusay got transplanted to Sandal Hill. And then Saddam Hussein was found in a rat hole. And then he was put on trial, and then he danced on the gallows. Yes. There's a mindset, a Middle East mindset about death. It is different than the Western mindset about death. Even in car accidents, these people have a different mindset about death. I don't know what it is, but it's cold. It's really something. So, it wasn't until Kuwait that we got our American pride back. See, once the communists get you down, they keep you down. They keep you depressed. They'll give you drugs to jump up, but then when you jump up, you got to come down. So, at the time, I was a first lieutenant in the Army's 7th Special Forces Group, conducting a mission on the tidal edge of the Third Indochina War. 5 years earlier, after U.S. troops had completed their withdrawal from Vietnam and Saigon had fallen, deep historical and fresh political animosities had ignited a complicated East-West contest involving the Soviets and the Chinese, as well as the Vietnamese. Now, how are you going to fight an enemy when you go to the combat zone and they tell you don't kill any Russians and don't kill any Chinese? And there were the Russians unloading weapons of to kill Americans up in Haiphong Harbor. And the Chinese are also doing the same thing, plus running in dope for their chemical warfare program. I deployed to neighboring Thailand to lead a four-man special forces team in teaching the Thai Army how to use a shoulder-fired Dragon missile system against any Vietnamese tanks that might cross the border. 4 years after graduating from West Point, I was a seasoned lieutenant and excited to be in the field, leading a small but important mission far from oversight. This was not a practice on a barren military range, and my anxious Thai counterparts reminded me of the urgency. But my discussion with Lieutenant Tawachi that muggy morning on the Thai Army base near Pranburi carried my thoughts far away from Southeast Asia to the desert of Iran. The Wachi was a muscular officer with obvious energy. He's talking about the desert in Iran where the rescue mission was going in to bring out the embassy captives. Okay? That was the mission. There is a guy that everybody made fun of, but he drew a lot of votes and probably got Clinton reelected, and that was, what was his name? Oh, man, his name escapes me. He looked like the chicken guy. Ross Perot. His name was Ross Perot. And he went in. His people were also in an Iranian prison. And he hired a special forces officer, and they went in and they got all the guys out of prison. And that's what made him a hero to the American people, because he, as a businessman and a loner, could do what Jimmy Carter couldn't do as the ruler of the free world. The Wachi was a muscular officer who's with obvious energy held in check as we sat drinking tea in a small coffee shop. He was one of the first four Thai soldiers selected to train on the notoriously difficult Dragon because of his skills in marksmanship and English. He was pro-American, and his face reflected pain when he excitedly asked me, "Have you heard?" I had. President Carter had just told the world that he had aborted the rescue mission, and the news and images moved rapidly, even to Pranburi. There was no fighting, Carter had said. There was no combat, but eight men had died. He explained, when two of our American aircraft collided on the ground following a refueling operation in a remote desert location in Iran. I pictured American aircraft smoldering in the desert, and I thought about the men who had perished. You see, he's thinking about his fellow soldiers. Now, you don't think he wouldn't make a good president? You think that he would send your child into harm's way without having to make that heavy decision? You know, what a difference between a guy that wouldn't take any phone calls while guys were dying on rooftops in Benghazi. I don't want to be disturbed. See Hillary, and Hillary hung up the phone. I pictured American aircraft smoldering in the desert, and I thought about the men who had perished. Like most Americans, I had watched Iran closely since Tuesday, January 16, 1979. On that day, after facing more than a year of volatile public opposition, the Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi fled Iran. 2 weeks later, the Shah's longtime opponent, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, returned to Tehran from his 14-year exile in France, where he was catered to by the French government, the same French government that we went into Indochina for. Inspired by the Ayatollah, a mob of more than 500 Iranian students stormed the U.S. Embassy on Sunday, November the 4th, 1979, seized 66 Americans. Many Iranians believed the embassy had been headquarters for the 53 coup that first installed the Shah, a point Khomeini and others hammered in their anti-American diatribes, and many saw the takeover as a necessary step to prevent an impending American intervention. Hang in a second, and I'm going to read you something. It just so it ties in with what we're talking about right now. So just hang in one second. Let me see if I can call it up. It was a clip that I took out of an Iranian a bulletin today. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah, figures. Here we go. Let me see. No. Let's see if I can get it this way. Sorry about this. Nothing come easy for me. Ah, I think I got it. Here it is. Okay. This is taken from memory. It's an outfit, M-E-M-R-I. They interpret all communications and bulletins and magazine articles from the Middle East. They can do it in Arabic. They can do it in Farsi. They can do it in Urdu. And this is what they took down today. Iranian military officials boasted today, "The Americans will know Iran's true power when their warships with over 5,000 aboard sink during a confrontation with Iran." Now, you know that the Chinese have developed the missiles to sink aircraft carriers, and they're practicing the sinking of aircraft carriers in the Gobi Desert. They're sharing that information with the Iranians because you can see these people are talking warships with 5,000 aboard. Only an aircraft carrier has 5,000 aboard. Okay? And when that aircraft carrier goes down, where did the planes go that took off from it? "The Iranian nation will hand them, the Americans, a crushing defeat. We are prepared with ballistic missiles, swift boats, and mines." So I did my response, "Late breaking news. The two Americans who were selected to fight the entire Iranian military have redesigned the neutron bomb. It is programmed to kill only men, and then we will take the women and children, and won't they be happy? Beware of Operation Candy Flowers, Kites, and Burka Bikinis. Caution, under American rules, women will be punished if their burkas are too long. They will get no champagne." Okay, so just a little, you know, little flippancy. Let me go back to where we were. Oh, here we go. "And many Iranians believe the embassy had been headquarters for the 1953 coup that first reinstalled the Shah, a point Khomeini and others hammered home. The American public reacted emotionally. Yellow ribbons were hung. Nightly newscast ended with somber declarations of the number of days since the crisis started. And many asked, what is happening to America? What were we going to do? If you think they're asking what is happening to America then, you ought to hear what's happening to America now. The Watchi pressed the same question. He had high expectations for America's role in the world. So my initial answers explaining the complexity of hostage rescue operations and the ever-present chance of failure didn't satisfy him. His question was far broader. He repeated himself, emphasizing, you're the United States of America, as though I might have forgotten. His reaction reinforced to me that the cost of failure was far, far higher than just the immediate loss of life. In years ahead, I would see more times when the confidence, hopes, and the prestige of the nation
rested on the shoulders of a small group of committed professionals. The cost of any failed special operation is high. President Carter bravely accepted responsibility for the failure, but even so, it stung. This felt like a humiliating demonstration of our inability to execute difficult missions like hostage rescues, especially in comparison with recent successes by our allies. I had been impressed in July 76 when Israeli commandos had reached deep into Africa to rescue passengers from a hijacked Air France flight being held at the airport in Entebbe, Uganda. 2 years later, as a paratroop lieutenant, I had watched on the news as French Foreign Legionnaires parachuted into southeastern Zaire and saved thousands of French and Zairean hostages from anti-Mobutu rebels. And just 10 days after our failed mission in Iran, the British Special Air Service, SAS, had freed 19 hostages held by Arab separatists at the Iranian embassy in London. Eagle Claw, as the failed operation was known, was more tactically complex and difficult than these raids, but we made it look impossible. On Wednesday, January the 21st, 1981, the hostages' release lifted the pall that the ordeal had cast over America. But the failure in the Iranian desert would cast a long shadow over U.S. special operations. You notice he doesn't hold Jimmy Carter responsible. He is an officer that serves the president. I hold Jimmy Carter responsible, and I also remember that he didn't want the football near him. And he instructed that it should be at least 9 miles away. On Wednesday, January the 21st, the lifted the pall. Okay, a commission under retired Navy Admiral James Holloway would capture in stark terms what had gone wrong and, most important, what needed to be done. It would provide initial direction for a journey that would shape the rest of my career. That career had started nearly 4 years earlier when I reported to Fort Benning, Georgia, and there in early August 76, 2 months after graduating, I left behind the logical, theoretical world of West Point to begin my real-world education, graduate work in the nuts and bolts of soldiering. I also volunteered for Ranger School. A 9-week Ranger course was created at the outset of the Korean War as a way to teach leadership by simulating the stress of combat. It had developed its own mythology, stories of sleep deprivation, hunger, physical exhaustion, and instructors who did their best to make the course hell led many officers to decide against attempting it. Fewer than 80 of 200 lieutenants from my basic course chose to attend and intimidated those of us who did. Still wearing the Ranger tab on our left shoulder would be an important step in establishing our bona fides as soldiers. Rangers have a rich lineage. During World War II, Ranger units conducted high-risk missions across North Africa and the Nazi underbelly in Sicily and Italy. They rescued American POWs from the Japanese camp at Cambanatuan in the Philippines. On D-Day at Normandy, the 2nd Ranger Battalion, a unit I would later command, climbed the cliffs of the angular bluff called Point du Hoc under the downpour of enemy fire to locate and destroy enemy guns. The post-war army of 1973, struggling to rebuild a professionalism and pride badly shattered in a painful, unpopular war, launched a new era of Rangers. In November 1976, we arrived in the Harmony Church area of Fort Benning. There in World War II-era wooden buildings, the Rangers had established a Spartan enclave set apart from the more relaxed standards of the 1970s Army at large. Many Ranger instructors wore high and tight haircuts, made a point of fitness and prided themselves on their apparent indifference to physical discomfort. During the military post Vietnam Nadir, Harmony Church was a refuge for the flint of the Army. Many of the instructors, like Staff Sergeant Swackhammer, were larger-than-life characters. His Dickensian name haunted the first phase of the course, and he treated the Fort Benning as sawdust pits, where he taught hand-to-hand combat like the sands of the Colosseum. When we shivered under our winter gear during patrols later in the course, another iconic RI Sergeant First Class Jutras, erect and seemingly comfortable in a single layer of summer fatigues, taunted us in a thick Rhode Island accent. "Cold, Ranger?" Law had it that once in the final phase of the course conducted in the swamps of Florida, Jutras had continued a lecture on poisonous snakes, despite being bitten, calmly describing for the Ranger students the feeling as the venom took effect. After Vietnam, everyone had an opinion on what ailed the military and how to fix it. My class's tactical officer waged his personal war for the soul of the Army, convinced that West Point lieutenants tended to band together and carry weak classmates through Ranger School. He sought to make the early weeks of the course so painful and difficult that the weak would be culled from the ranks and denied Ranger tabs they couldn't earn on individual merit. His favorite tool was the worm pit, a long mud-filled ditch covered at about 18 inches with a canopy of barbed wire. Through the cold of November and December, we crawled through the mud and water, and the first of us breaking the ice on top as we crawled. One night, I watched as five lieutenants in my platoon quit. In accordance with Ranger School policy, they signed lack of motivation statements, forfeiting forever any chance of winning Ranger tabs and accepting a stigma that would follow them for the rest of their military careers. Leadership lessons often came unexpectedly. One evening early in the course, we conducted a 6-mile speed march, at the end of which our tactical officer took us to the physical training PT field. We shivered as the sweat from the march chilled us, a steam rising from our shaved heads in the cold of night and the glare of field lights. After a short time, we were ordered to navigate the obstacle course and worm pit, crawling through the icy slush. Rapidly, the cold produced a spasmodic breathing, and our limbs and hands became unable to grasp ropes or perform motor functions. It felt as though we had crossed the line between hard and being dangerously stupid. Suddenly, the field lights flashed, and another Ranger instructor, a master sergeant, shouted instruction to us to go immediately to our wooden barracks up the hill from the field. Our tactical officer, a major, surprised by the countermanding officer from a subordinate, protested, yet in our joy to be released from the cold and the pain, we ran from the field as quickly as our nearly hypothermic bodies would carry us. Even in my haste, I was struck by the courageous action of the master sergeant in stopping the foolishness. Tragically, several weeks later, we were in a mountain phase of the course. Cold killed two Ranger students in the class ahead of ours as they patrolled in the swamp phase in Florida. The essential vehicle for teaching leadership was a small unit patrol. Instructors graded students on how well they led squads and platoons, frequently rotating the Ranger students assigned leadership of positions, because patrol leaders depended on the support of fellow students. A cooperate and graduate attitude permeated the class. Yet cooperation was challenging when fatigue and hunger wore down otherwise good team players. Most of us found the personal discipline required when the things were tough was an accurate measure of the man. Some of our classmates from West Point had been puffed up as cadets, but buckled once they were shivering in the woods. One fellow student stood in stark contrast. Lieutenant Dave Rod Rodriguez, caught my attention. A 6'4", 230-pound defensive end. And when we were together at West Point, Rod was quiet and modest, yet wickedly funny. One night, assigned to lead our exhausted patrol away from an objective to a base on the route calculated to take up to 7 hours of walking, Rod studied the map and gave the order to ruck up. And despite the tired legs and heavy rucksacks, we moved purposely enough to reach the base in less than 2 hours. A good man, I noted, that doesn't mess around. At our graduation in February, the Ranger tab did not make us swag hammers or juttresses. No one was instantly stronger, braver, or smarter with it on his shoulder. But it changed the way others viewed us and thus changed the way we viewed ourselves. We're going to take a break. We'll give you a tune, and then we'll come back. College while I was in Ranger School, and after a couple of months to allow me to grow back some hair and become redomesticated, we were married in a military ceremony where her father was stationed at Fort Monroe, Virginia. We had no money for a honeymoon and instead loaded our 74 Chevy Vega and moved into our one-bedroom, $180 per month apartment in a complex near Fort Bragg. Most of the possessions sat on the shelves we made of cinder blocks and wood planks, but it felt right. In many ways, Annie and I learned together. One Friday night, as a platoon leader, I scheduled a parachute jump, which typically finished after midnight, thus stealing part of the men's weekend. As we strapped on our parachutes, I sensed their resentment and decided to raise morale by suggesting that after recovering from the operation, they all come to my place for a platoon party. I did not routinely hang out with subordinates, but this was a moment to build the team. The plan was set, but in the age before cell phones, it was not relayed to Annie. Although it would be late by the time we would finish the jump and begin the gathering, I assumed I could get home before everyone arrived. But the platoon sergeant, Emil Holtz, an enormous mortar man to the liquor store, while the rest of them cleaned equipment. In spite of his looming appearance, Holtz was a quiet, cerebral teetotaler. Unsure what the boys drank at parties, he bought a lot of everything with the cash they gave him. Soon after, Annie answered the door in her nightgown, still unaware of the party plan, to find what looked like Andre the Giant holding clinking grocery bags of liquor, wine, and beer. LT says we're having a party, he said bashfully. Others soon arrived. By the time I got home, Annie had already met most of the platoon and made them snacks. Later, she sat laughing and warmly chatting with a soldier's girlfriend, a nice girl who danced topless locally, but who had dressed conservatively for the party. Annie's instinctive ability to make others feel welcomed and in situations more dire comforted and shone through. Although when I first met Annie, she made it clear to me that she did not want to date or marry a soldier. I think she was more comfortable in an Army family than she readily admitted. From her Army brat upbringing, Annie deeply admired her parents. Her memories tinged with bittersweet goodbyes and uncomfortable moments as the new kid in school are invariably dominated by funny stories of her and five siblings being packed into station wagons or small quarters. I soon found that Annie had an indefinable quality, call it pluck, that made duty feel like privilege and made our Army life an adventure. In the fall of 78, I made a decision to apply for Special Forces training. Lieutenant Colonel Dave Barato, my tactical officer from West Point, was commanding a battalion of the 7th Special Forces Group at Fort Bragg, and after seeking his counsel, I submitted my request. The reputation of SF at that time was mixed at best, but I wanted to become part of something that long ago had captured my imagination. Just after I left the 82nd, the Chief of Staff, General Rogers, stripped the paratroopers of their maroon berets to rein in other units that had begun wearing various non-standard berets and other headgear. General Rogers issued a blanket ban. The loss of the maroon beret, the accepted paratrooper symbol worldwide, and a badge of pride was traumatic for the 82nd. At the time, it seemed to me, though Army leadership, despite good intentions, was tone deaf to what mattered to the volunteer soldiers of its own force. Remember I told you the story about the berets? They ordered 500,000, and there was only one small businesswoman in the USA that could fill the order, and she needed to do it in three increments, and so they said no. We're going to farm it out to a company in England. And the company in England turned around and refarmed it out to the Chinese. And that's how American stupidity is prevalent in the world today. By the time the paratroopers lost their maroon berets, I was wearing a green one. In November 1978, I joined Detachment 714, Company A, 1st Battalion, 7th Special Forces Group, Airborne, part of the U.S. Army's famous and in minds of some infamous Green Berets. Created midway through the Korean War, the Special Forces were modeled on the OSS World War II Jedburgh's three-man teams dropped deep into Nazi-occupied Europe to recruit and lead partisan guerrillas. In Vietnam, the Green Berets played their largest role to date, and stories of their operations and exploits have fascinated me from an early age. So, then he got assigned to a 12-man team, And Special Forces history was tinged with politics. During the 60s presidential campaign, John F. Kennedy's staff sought to burnish his defense credentials. Other senators had associated themselves with high-profile weapons like the Polaris missile or B-52. Kennedy would adopt the Special Forces. And when the new president authorized the headgear as a mark of distinction, as he explained on June 6, 62, to a graduating cadets gathered in the West Point Fieldhouse, Kennedy envisioned that his infantrymen would likely face small, hot, peripheral wars, new in intensity, ancient in origin, against the guerrillas, subversives, insurgents, exploiting economic unrest and ethnic conflicts. Oh, that's going on right here in this country. When they trained the South Vietnamese, as the war escalated under President Johnson, I got to tell you, Democrats get you into war and they leave you on the battlefield to die. And then they promise they'll never run again. But it's a tradition with Democrats. And it's all the way from Korea to Benghazi. They became highly publicized, and despite some extraordinary exploits by the end of the war, controversies dogged the force. Criticisms range from being elitist to being off the reservation to Time magazine, August 1969, damning description. Time magazine is the enemy of the people, as is Newsweek. If you want to see a classic picture of the Newsweek tactics, just Google Pearl Harbor issue in Japanese and see the cover of Time magazine. You will see one or two American flags in a garbage can. And that's Time magazine's salute to Pearl Harbor in Japanese. It was a Japanese issue. And I bet you the Japs didn't like it either. By the time I joined the Green Berets, oh, wait a minute, let me see here. We were talking, enveloped in the sinister, after the company investigated the Green Beret commander in Vietnam, along with six intelligence officers, after accusations that they had murdered an alleged South Vietnamese double agent. By the time I joined the Green Berets, they only faintly resembled their Kennedy-era forebears. Traditionally, the Army had an aversion to elite units because such units tended to siphon resources, particularly talented forces from the soldiers from the rest of the force. After Vietnam, that resistance reemerged and special forces were allowed to atrophy. Young officers often terse advice to avoid ruining their careers by joining special forces. So you want to join the speckled feces? An officer in my battalion had put to me when I left the 82nd. Early on, some of my worst fears were realized. My Special Forces officers course included several lieutenants who had been fired in the 82nd. At the time, a rare occurrence. Some of the instructors were equally disappointing. A lecture was stopped one day as a senior instructor had to remove an obviously drunk sergeant from the stage. My company commander was relieved for inappropriate conduct during a training deployment. It made for amusing stories, but it really wasn't funny. It was a difficult time, and some talented, combat-experienced Green Beret officers and NCOs, non-commissioned officers, became disillusioned and unmotivated. The routine of peacetime service didn't suit them. For a young leader, these veterans were an intimidating challenge. I faced that challenge early. As a new detachment AT leader, I felt that the respected and experienced team sergeant of our 12-man A-team had grown lazy and needed to be moved from the position. For a young lieutenant team leader, a position designed for a more senior captain, making this assessment was difficult, and acting on it was even harder. He had fought a war as a Green Beret. My beret was still new and I had never been to war. So I sought and received the support of my chain of command and we made the change, replacing him with a 29-year-old combat veteran with less experience but vastly greater energy. That's rough, man. That's a rough thing to do. It was not an action taken lightly, yet I found surprising support for the move across the unit, particularly from veteran NCOs, and realized that the foundation of professionalism in special forces was stronger than it first appeared to be. The experience I underwent as a team leader helped transform my career. I had about as much latitude as a post-Vietnam lieutenant would have. Received great support, but no micromanagement from my commanders, and set the standards and direction for my team. Although theoretically my team was already elite soldiers, I found they wanted someone to push and lead them, reflecting the truism that most soldiers respond when challenged. But as good as my practical education became in the Special Forces, it was incomplete. In 1980, my fourth year of commissioned service, I wanted something more than training, something that mattered, something real. The Soviets had invaded Afghanistan. In Nicaragua, the Sandinistas had overthrown Anastasio Somoza, who had been at West Point with my father. And, of course, Iranian revolutionaries had ousted the Shah and then seized the American embassy in Tehran. The global tumult made training at Fort Bragg feel increasingly irrelevant as a young officer who was honing his craft. We'll give you another tune, and we'll come back, and we'll do some more.
Let's see what we got here.
Will you take part in
So he did a tour in Korea, which was non-eventful. The North Korean soldiers were hardened faces and glowered at us while we stared back. The area was rarely violent, but it was always tense. And a year later, North Korean soldiers killed two Americans who were in the DMZ trimming a tree that blocked the view from the south. As I finished my uneventful year in Korea, I had also completed my five-year commitment to the Army. But I decided I had also seen some amazing leaders and experienced bonds with soldiers that I found fulfilling. And I sensed that changes were afoot in the Army. My sense was right. While I was experiencing a low point of my career in Korea, the U.S. military had begun its renaissance. A confluence of factors would move the Army forward. Much of the improvement that I would experience firsthand, namely the revitalization of special operations, was set in motion by the military's reckoning with the failure of the Iranian desert in 1980. Operation Eagle Claw was designed to rescue 53 Americans held hostage at two locations in the heart of Tehran, an urban thicket of more than 4 million people. Planners decided that to penetrate the Tehran and reach those targets undetected, they would have to drive into the city. But once the alarm rang, there would be a firefight and they would need helicopters to escape. These helicopters would meet the rescue teams at a nearby soccer stadium within Tehran. The 600 miles that separated Tehran from the Arabian Sea-based aircraft carriers the helicopters would launch from was beyond the distance that those helicopters could fly without refueling, thus the need for fixed-wing aircraft to shuffle teams and fuel between the planes and the helicopters. The teams would need to make makeshift airfields during the approach and escape legs. To infiltrate the rescue force, two sets of aircraft would fly into Iran across its southern border. First, a C-130 aircraft carrying Army Special Operators, Army Rangers, and 6,000-gallon bladders of fuel for the helicopters would leave from a tiny island off the coast of Oman. Those tiny islands are now challenged by Iran. They want them for themselves. 1,000 miles from Tehran, 2nd Navy helicopters, empty except for the Marines piloting them, would be on their heels, taking off from the USS Nimitz. All would rendezvous at night on the desert airstrip, codenamed Desert One, southeast of Tehran. To avoid detection at the airstrip, the teams would transfer and the helicopters would refuel without illumination. The ground teams would then travel by helicopter to the outskirts of Tehran, Desert Two, where the soldiers would spend the night hiding in advance of the early morning assault. When the convoys converged on Iran early the next morning, Army Rangers would capture, secure, and hold a second air base southwest of the capital city. After the rescue at the embassy, the escape helicopters would fly from the soccer stadium to this airbase, where a second fleet of C-141s would be waiting to ferry the force and rescue hostages to freedom. In all, the mission called for 44 aircraft, thousands of gallons of fuel, a fleet of ground vehicles, and a hybrid force culled from the Navy, Army, Marines, Air Force, and intelligence services. It required securing a desert landing strip in darkness, seizing and holding a second airfield, striking two urban targets, engaging in a firefight to get out of Tehran, and exfiltrating to a friendly airspace. At best, the plan was a series of difficult missions, each a variable in a complex equation. At worst, with an ad hoc team, it called for a string of miracles. Launched on Thursday, April 24, 1980, 173 days into the hostage crisis, the mission faltered early. As with all operations, the plan had certain built-in criteria that, if not met, would require the mission to be aborted. In this case, the number of operating helicopters, if it fell below six, they would have to abort the mission. Out of the eight originally lost, the operation would not continue. Five helicopters could not carry a team large enough to overpower the enemy at the embassy. Shortly after entering Iranian airspace, one was abandoned due to mechanical failure. The remaining seven helicopters are flying low to evade radar detection, flew into a series of habub, vast milk-thick columns of suspended dust that form in the desert. The clouds were the size of mountains 1,000 feet high. They swallowed the speeding helicopters for hours, obscuring anything much further than the cockpit windows. After one helicopter turned back, only six landed at Desert One. On the cusp of launching the second leg of the operation, one of the helicopters was deemed inoperable. With only 5 helicopters, fewer than the mission minimum, the commanders aborted, preparing to exfiltrate, and blinded by kicked-up sand in the night, one of the helicopters crashed into the nose of a C-130 that was full of soldiers and fuel. The plane caught fire, and the full fuel bladder in the fuselage ignited, killing 8 operators trapped inside. Eagle Claw was America's first attempt at a new type of special operations warfare, characterized by politically sensitive, complex, fast, a joint operation. Its failure largely owed to insufficient bandwidth of every type. The force did not have command and decision-making processes in place. While commanders on the ground were in contact with the White House, some of the helicopter pilots later admitted they did not know who was in charge at Desert One until the operation was over. The assembled teams were not a bonded joint force, as they had not operated or even fully rehearsed together before crossing into Iranian airspace. The demands at operational security were understandably heavy, but the mission was too corseted. Security concerns prevented weather analysts who knew the helicopters might encounter a haboob from briefing the pilots. Their forecasts were filtered out when the intelligence reports moved through the organization. The calamity of Desert One was not a failure of political or military courage. The failure occurred long beforehand when the military, faced with limited resources, talent, and focus, failed to build and maintain a force necessary to accomplish these kinds of missions. In response to this failure, the Holloway Commission recommended creating a counter-terrorist joint force and would plan, train for, and conduct operations to counter terrorist activities directed against the United States. Following the commission's report, there was born a renewed interest in special operations. Iranian state television looped footage of the charred aircraft and bodies at Desert One. The Iranian officials triumphantly displayed the blackened remains of the Americans at a press conference in Tehran the next day. With special operations, Desert One became the synonym for failure and a powerful, if at all times unspoken, rallying cry. Pictures of the wreckage with the clearly implied message, "Never Again," hung on office walls and were posted in barracks. Over the next 2 decades, we rehearsed hundreds of operations to ensure we could get it right when we needed to. There were lessons learned and costs dearly paid, but the force that nation needed would eventually emerge. And then what happened to it at Benghazi? Where was that rescue team? That rescue team was nowhere. That is sad. And that is the end of Chapter 3. And I hope I didn't bore you. You know, a guy reading a book on a radio show, I don't know. But I had to get it out there because I believe that our country is going to need a general president because World War III is coming and we're invited. We're the guest of honor. And I'm watching these cyberspace warriors that they call themselves. And they can't answer the question, can we be taken down? All they can say is, we hope not. And that's not good enough for me. So we'll close with a tune. And being that all the religious people are being persecuted in this country by the communists, we'll do my prayer.
When the twilight is gone, and no songbirds are singing, when the twilight is gone, you come into my heart, and here in my heart you will stay. While I pray, my prayer of the day. In a dream that's divine, close to mine. You know what our hearts are aglow. Oh, tell me the word that I'm longing to know. At the end of my...